One of the themes that I talked about yesterday was the fact that we do have an obligation to love our kids enough to say we're not perfect, and there may be times that you need to forgive me because I'm selfish. I will I'll do stuff that I like to do and not consider sometimes mom, and sometimes I won't consider you, and we'll make plans, or I'll forget promises or whatever. And if you don't have a gracious, forgiving heart that God has for dad, if you don't have it, it won't be long before the relationship will be pretty strained. Communication will break down. It's really interesting because I have found that progression, that those of you who were here yesterday, I found that progression applied to God as well. A wounded spirit, when the person who's an authority in your life has hurt you, the progression was, anybody remember what it was? Breakdown of communication, alienation of affection, rejection of authority, establishing yourself as authority. And guess what I did, not only with my parents, but I did that with God too. When things happened in my life that I had no control over and it made me angry at God, including, I have four daughters. They were, you know, 6, 4, 2, and newborn. But we had had a first child on Thanksgiving Day, a little boy, first year of marriage, and he didn't make it. And I was a pastor, a youth pastor working with teenagers, and guess what my prayer life looked like in those months that followed? What is the first thing when you have a wounded spirit and you're hurt? Breakdown of communication. Alienation of affection. I still did my job. I still worked with staff. I still worked with people in the church, but I didn't understand. It was hurtful to lose a child, a little boy named Jonathan. I'm David. Had his name to come home each day and have a nursery all decorated, ready to go, and nobody in it. And yeah, we did have four more girls, but that took some time to say, it wasn't about forgiving God, it was just understanding that this is a broken world. And I know when things happen that are hard in life, the person that's the authority is where the communication breaks down. And for me and my job, it was God. And then what do? You set yourself up as authority. Breakdown of communication, alienation of affection. Affection just kind of, you don't run to meet dad when he's hurt you. You stay in your room. And then you start to make decisions that you make sense to you rather than them. So anyway, that was kind of yesterday. And today we're going to talk about a progression that also is, I think, very important. And that is that your kids need to have hope. One of the things that when I've asked junior high or high school, and I was a youth pastor for 30 years and still have interns. In fact, one of my interns called me from Colorado because he's now a pastor in Colorado. And he called me this morning because he wants to be in my fantasy football team or in my league, in our league that we run with our staff at our church. And since he was on staff, he goes, can I still stay in the league? And I said, sure, I know you're in Colorado, but we'll keep you in there. But anyway, I'm still getting calls. I still work with teenagers, young adults, and college students. And one of the things that I recognize in this steps to independence is that in working with kids, one of the things that you ask, what do you want more than anything else? And most of them say, I want more freedom. I mean, I want to be more free. And so that's one of the things that I'm hoping will be helpful today is these steps, because when I communicate with my four daughters, you know, it's not my plan to be responsible and to take care of you and to be your authority and to whatever, to make decisions for you for the rest of your life. I want to guide you. I want to invest time with you and spend time with you and go on dates, and we want to do stuff and talk about life and whatever, because it's my intention is to put your hand in God's hand, not my hand. The sooner you're safer and on your own and making wise decisions and stuff, the happier I'll be. Because I haven't done that well for myself, but I want to help you maybe not make some of the mistakes I made. And so Steps to Independence is part of that. But I want you to take just a moment and talk to the person next to you, including your spouse, if that's the case. Share your favorite thing about being a parent and maybe the least favorite thing about being a parent. And I'm only going to give you about 90 seconds for this because of the time shortage, but... I'll have it in a second. Yeah. Anybody want to answer the question? What's your favorite thing about being a parent? Anybody? Yeah. Okay, listen up, just because of time, we're gonna, that way you get to know each other, but also I'm gonna interrupt you. Yeah.
I think our oldest is 13, our youngest is 5, so I think just seeing those moments of like maturity, like glimpses that they may just turn out all right, kind of thing, like where you're like, wow, did you be nice to your sibling?
That's a great one. Yeah, the great thing is to see them suddenly catch on and they're actually nice to each other. And you go, wow, there's hope. That is a good thing. Anybody else have a favorite thing about being a parent? I think,
Well, and maybe hinged with what you shared with us, is just that it's a miracle, and that's my favorite thing.
It is.
The indwelling of life, pregnant.
Yeah, the miracle of new life. It really is. And if you have had kids long enough to see the genetic, you know, the genetic, you mean, oh my gosh, it's so scary to see. Well, because I had in my own experience was I'm yelling at my kids and I hear my dad in the hallway and it's my voice echoing down the hallway yelling. And I went, oh my gosh, that is exactly the sound of my dad when he was yelling at me as a kid. That's pretty scary, but to see the genetic. I had my daughter, Christy, who's got long toes like I do, but you know, she makes her a great surfer because she can grip the board and stuff. But my I remember when she came up to me one day and she said, well, the older sisters always tease me about being adopted, you know, that, you know, harassment. And she said, and she looked at my feet and she said, but it's really clear, I'm your daughter. So that was fun. I mean, to me, it was good. She was glad, you know. Anybody else? What about the worst thing about being a parent?
Living through the pain.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there is pain. I was a lit major in Santa Barbara, and there was that literature question of Shakespeare, is it better to have loved and lost than not have loved at all? And I never thought that was a difficult question to answer. It's always better to love and to lose. And let me tell you, when you drive your daughter to college, it doesn't get any easier the fourth time to let them out of the car and help them move into their dorm room and realize that probably is the last time. Loving hurts. It hurts to love. It hurts to have a loving relationship. And when some of the people that hurt you are the ones that are the closest, you know, the ones you love are the ones that hurt you, that's also part of what it means to be a parent. And that's probably my least favorite thing, is when you feel Like I shared yesterday with Wendy, my daughter who was ballet and all that, to have her so angry at me and to feel like I couldn't do anything about it until she decided to forgive me. Because I couldn't go back. I can't go back and change even me. And to recognize that one of the reasons that I surfed and did so much activity was some of the pain in my own life, including losing a first little boy. That's what I did to get over the pain, was I got busy. I didn't share this yesterday, but at one point, you know, with four little girls, I was still dealing with unrecovered pain, you know, because I had to go back to work and work at a church with an empty nursery. And that pain doesn't go away. In fact, I still have it. If I were to talk about it and talk about Jonathan and holding this little baby boy with black hair and having him crying in my arms, I mean, I still have pain over that. So when you talk about pain in with you and your family and you realize that's where it comes from family, you recognize that unrecovered pain is always there. I mean, it will always be present. And so surfing became something that I did. And then when I had my wife and four daughters and I had all these young people that said, hey, Dave, you want to go surf on Saturday? I'd go, yeah, let's go. Because that's how you keep the pain at bay. And then the year-end trips to Disneyland. And then the Mexico trips. And then the India trips. And then the Israel trips. And at one point, a good friend of mine said, you know, you need to be a dad for your four daughters. You're a great youth pastor, but your daughters aren't in your youth group yet. And I figured out my year schedule. I was away 20, because I'm not the senior pastor. I can go do stuff with teenagers and go to Mexico and take my interns down to Bahia, Los Angeles, and surf down there along the Mexico coast. And I did. And why did I do that? Because my wife eventually said to me, she said, you know, you're an adrenaline addict. And I realized she was right. I felt better when I was, that's why I ran too. I just ran the wharf to wharf here last Sunday, 6 miles. But the reason is that I looked at my schedule, I was away 28 weekends out of 52. Speak, because I worked with youth specialties, say, hey, can you speak in Texas and on youth ministry? Sure, I'll go with a team. And so I joined that. And I spoke in Orlando and Boston and San Antonio, Denver, was away. I'd come home, and I'd come home to four girls. A couple of them that would run to me and say, hi, Dad, welcome home. And Wendy would be one that would you'd have to go looking for. So anyway, that was yesterday. Share favorite thing of parent. Oh, here it goes.
Parent fitness training, coping with your child's behavioral challenges. Where'd you get this?
They were sticking them on the windshield at Chuck E. Cheese's.
Come on, you don't need glasses, we're great parents. All right, you're a great parent, and I'm your lovely assistant.
Well, I don't feel like a great parent. Great parents don't find themselves in the supermarket going, we don't throw plums. We need a class. We need a class.
A parenting class? That's supposed to come natural. That'd be like taking a smelling class.
So you have nothing to learn here.
Oh, come on. My mom and dad never took a parenting class. I'm signing them up for this.
Yeah, he wants to sign his parents up for that. A little late. Three words that describe the kind of parent you are. Do that next to each other, but just again, 90 seconds. How would you describe the kind of parent you are in three words? Individual, separate words.
Thank you.
Anybody want to throw out a word? How would you describe yourself?
Enabling.
Enabling. Okay, good one.
Reactionary.
Reactionary. Yeah, good one. Another one, throw out another one. You heard or feel like you are?
Involved.
Involved. Good. Good word.
Old.
Old. Good one. That's a great one. Wow. Yeah. Good one. There's a very important verse in Scripture, and I got it read to me in numerous times in my teenage years, because I was, as I told the group yesterday, I was 9 years younger than my brother, 12 years younger than my sister, and 14 years younger than my older sister, Diana, and Joan was 12 years older. And so by the time I came along, they were pretty much done parenting, and so I was just kind of raised myself and did a lot of things separately. When I do the personality test of Myers-Briggs and oldest, youngest, middle, you know, those characteristics are very interesting. I'm definitely a youngest, but I'm also have a lot of the characteristics of an only child because I created games. I'm very creative. I learned how to play, and that's how I ended up throwing baseballs against my garage door and breaking the window of the brand new car. But anyway, those interesting things, the very important verse that I got read to very often was, children, obey your parents and the Lord, for this is right, and honor your father and mother. This was read to me when I was 12 and I crashed a Lincoln Continental. I had a really good job next door. It was like four houses down. I used to do the lawn, and I also was asked when she went to Hawaii. It was the people who owned the music store in town. Grassmux had a big music store in town, and they lived four doors from us, and I got to work for them. And so she was going to Hawaii, and she said, well, while you're here, can you water and do the lawn yard work? But there's also, we have a slow drain in our Lincoln Continental, and the battery will be dead by the time we get home. And so could you start it a couple times while I'm away? And as a 12-year-old, I went, oh, this is awesome. So I would get the sprinklers on, and it was back in the days, they didn't even have automatic sprinklers. They had the metal thing. I'm so glad somebody remembers the metal thing you turned on, and you turned the sprinklers on, and you run them for 10 minutes, and then you'd switch it. Well, while we were there, I thought, you know, I was thinking that was probably the second day or third day. I thought, you know, I really don't know how quickly this car drains out, so I'm going to get in, and I'll start it. And I turned the radio on and ran the power windows down, and kind of listen to music, and then I'd watch, and then I'd go change the sprinklers in the front and the side yard and the backyard and stuff. But then, you know, probably at the end of the first week, I thought, you know, I don't know if it charges as well when it's sitting still as when it's moving. And you got to make sure you be careful, because, you know, this is my job. And so I backed it up the driveway and pulled it back in, because I knew how to drive at 12. I did great and went out and pulled out, and then a couple times I pulled out in the street to look down the street to see if my friends were playing, and they weren't. And middle of the second week, I knew they were playing on Meadowbrook, the next street. I was in Calaveras. I grew up in Calaveras, and we went down Mar Vista and came to Meadowbrook to play. And so I thought, I'm just going to go by and show my friends I've got a job. So I pulled down, went down on Meadowbrook and pulled up, and they all cleared the street as this Lincoln Continental pulls up. But then one kind, remember it had the spare tire under the cover in the back? I mean, it was a beautiful car. Pulled up, hit the power light, the button down, and they looked in and went, oh my gosh, Dave, you got it. And I went, it's my job. And then I said, hop in, let's go for a ride. So they got in the car, four friends who were playing football, two in the back and a couple of actually sat up front because there was a big bench seat. And we went back to Holliston and went back up to my house, to my street, Calaveras, and I turned right and I said, okay, get out. And they said, take us back home. And I went, no, I'm not turning this thing around. I just went around the block and get out, you can walk back, and they got out. So I'm driving back toward Grassmuck's house, and my mom's coming the other direction. And she sees the car coming the other way, and they're going like this, and she stops to say hi to Mrs. Barry Grassmuck. And she thinks it's her, and she stops, and I kind of slowed down, and I sat real low, and she saw it was me, and she starts giving me the you know what, and I hit the power button on the window, went, and all I could see was she was going, and I went, I'm dead, and I pulled down the street, pulled in the driveway, and crashed it through the back of the garage. So I worked for the Grass Mucks for another couple years for free. And I remember getting read this verse, children, 12-year-old sons, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right, honor your father and mother. What I did not know is that there was a verse that followed that. And I didn't find that out till later, and I came back years later and got my Bible out, particularly when I started to go to seminary. And I said, you know, you never showed me this verse, Dad. And fathers, don't exasperate your children. And that's one of the things that I think happens when we feel like we have to be the authority. Because I've heard, particularly as a youth pastor in Oakland, I've heard parents, when I'm sitting there and come there to kind of try and mediate between the teenager and who I have a good friendship with and the parents, and as long as you're under the roof of this house, as long as you live here and you take advantage of being, you're going to, you know. And I think there's an in-between, and that's what I wanted to talk about. It's the ingredients of a relationship. You can have all the rules you want in a family, but if you don't have relationships with your children, you're going to have rebellion instead of response and respect. It's much like our relationship with God. If it's religion and rules, it doesn't work. Jesus didn't come to establish a different religion. He came to make a relationship possible with our Creator. And a relationship with our children is essential. Rules don't create respect and response. The ingredients of relationship also means good relationships are built on mutual respect. Respect begins with listening. When you experience someone listening, you feel respected. And that's true for mom and dad too. That I think there's a book, Listening is the Language of Love. And when somebody listens, in fact, he talked about it with eye contact. I see you. And when I see you, I listen and hear you. And that creates relationship. And that changes how discipline and all these other things that need to happen, respect rather than a wounded and hurt spirit. And so is your family a sand pile? A sand pile is when the grains of sand are just kind of chaotic, or is there a sand castle being built in your home? A sand castle is all the grains of sand have a place, and each of our kids are different, and they all have a place, and they have different interests, and they need to be a part of that castle, that kingdom. And if they don't feel like they're a part of it, then they're a sand pile. But if they can be a part of this kingdom and say, hey, we're gonna go, you know, and watch Carrie's soccer game. And yeah, that's the ballet girl goes along too, but then we go to the ballet performance because that's your interest and that's your heart. And so when we do family nights and do things, dad doesn't always pick what we do. It's a sand castle kingdom or it's a sand pile, and you have to just decide which it's gonna be and make it. Kingdoms are created by priorities and values and relationship. And a sand pile gets changed by the tides, the wind, and being a beach person, I've created many sand castles, but they no longer last because they're just affected by whether you take care of them or not, if you manage them. So here's Dave's top 10 of the mistakes I made as a dad, and I want to give that out to you. And can somebody help me distribute this just so we can walk through it? Thanks. Oh, sorry. Didn't mean to. Hope I didn't throw it. The first one is fail to listen when they are talking. That's interesting. That's the language of love. One. Number 10, fail to listen when they are talking. And I've seen, you can see it in TV shows, but you can also see it a lot in situations where person's busy watching a game and the little one comes in and wants to climb up in the lap and wants to tell you something. And it's nice now. I just tell you, it's a lot nicer now because we have a DVR and you can just push the pause button and watch live. And it didn't used to be that way, but there was a lot of situations in which dad would be watching something really important and the child would come in and try and talk to him and ask him a question or whatever. And just a minute. Nine is fail to remember what it was like when I was their age. I think that's probably the biggest thing when I would have parents' nights with teenagers, families in Oakland as a youth pastor, is the thing that I found is that a lot of parents didn't remember what it was like to be 12 or 13, to be a junior higher, to be to have a zit on your face and feel like it was a volcano. When I worked with junior high kids, the thing that I was fascinated by was that they were in an arena mentality. They felt the world was... I went to the A's-Giants game on Friday night. It was a fireworks thing, and there were like 40,000 people there, and this, you know, Oakland Coliseum was all filled. And I even thought about it then because I was thinking about this. I thought, you know, this is what it feels like to be a junior high. You're down on the field, and the entire world is in the stands watching you. And if you make one mistake or have the wrong shoes or a zit or something, the whole world is noticing. That's what it feels like to be in junior high. I still remember when I was playing catcher in high school. I was in 10th grade and playing on the team, and the big game against our rival, John Muir, I was playing for, and Pasadena High School we were playing, and the throw came on a, you know, is like a walk-off. The throw came to the plate. I was playing catcher. One hop, caught it, crashed. That was back in the days, and you could crash into the catcher. The runner crashed into me, and I went flying, and I reached into my glove, and the ball was gone. And the run scored, and they won. That was on Friday. Monday, I'm walking from the halls in school, and every person that looked at me, I knew what they were thinking. He dropped the ball. He dropped the ball. That's how it's like. That's what it's like. Nobody was thinking that. I would work with teenagers, and I go, you don't understand. Nobody's thinking about that. They're not thinking about you. They're thinking about themselves. Relax. They're all thinking about themselves, just like you are. So relax. Enjoy life. Lighten up. But that's what I felt like. And I remember thinking, one of the best things we can do is remember what it was like when we made a mistake or when we failed or when we screwed up or when we crashed a Lincoln Continental. It was amazing when one of the high school students, I think he was a junior, came in and he got a D in math. And he was going to have to go home and tell his parents. And he came by my house. I was a youth pastor. We were friends. And he was in my youth group, one of my student leaders. And he said, oh, man, I did really bad. And I said, hey, you know. And I told him some stories. And I told him about how I got a D in a class one time. And my daughter, who was an A student, after he leaves, comes out and goes, what the heck was that all about? And I said, what? She goes, you told him all this stuff about you. And she said, I've never heard that. I never heard that you got a D in math. I went, oh, yeah, I did. She said, well, where was this when I was struggling with stuff? And I said, you know, And then I said something I probably shouldn't have said. I said, well, I don't care if somebody else's kid's an idiot. Just if my kid, you know, and she laughed. She actually thought it was funny. But I realized that sometimes we don't remember and we don't share our own failures. And fortunately, I learned that early enough with my kids to recognize that there were a lot of things I made mistakes on. And I even told them that my mom said to me, probably around I was 16, 17, she said, "I hope to God someday you have a child who gives you as much heartache as you've given us." She was lovingly hugging me, but telling me a true statement. And so I brought my girls in front of my mom one day, and I said, "Mom, your prayers weren't answered. These girls have all been better than me." Anyway, fail to approve and be excited about their friends is another mistake, and that's something that I took a while to figure out, because what I found out was that wrong friends often means it's more a reflection of who they're compatible with. And they may not be hanging out with wrong friends. They may just be angry when they're not around you and more compatible with those that are heading in a direction that's maybe different than what I would have. But I, with your kids in Oakland Public Schools, as my girls were, one of the things I had to learn was just, you know, it's you're all welcome here. If you're my daughter's friend, you're welcome. Fail to give them the right to make mistakes. Catch them in doing something good was something that I mentioned yesterday. Number six, fail to take time to give them affection. You know, there's a lot of stuff about touching your kids and stuff, and one of the things that whether daughters or sons or whatever, a dad giving a son a hug is really awesome. Boy, I don't think you can touch your kids enough in the loving way. They are starved for it. And if they don't find it there, they will look for it elsewhere. And that's particularly true of girls. If dad doesn't hug them, if dad doesn't hold them, even when they don't want to, even when they don't like it, even when you have to kind of almost make it a joke and give them a big hug and embarrass them, I can't count the number of times I took my girls, let them out at school, got out of the car, gave them a big hug, and just embarrassed the heck out of them. Because I was actually up on Skyline High School campus when they started coming there as students, because I was a youth pastor, and I'd been on campus for 10, 15 years. And they started right. But this is what we did before. I met with them at breakfast the first day that Robin was going to be at Skyline. And I knew she was nervous, because I could tell. She was like nervous for weeks before. I'm going to be going to high school, and dad's going to be on the campus there having lunch with students and stuff. And I said, "We need to have a talk." She said, "What about?" I said, "About me being up there at your high school. Because I don't know many other kids that are going to have their parents there." She said, "Yeah, I know. I've been wondering about that." I said, "Here's what's going to be. If there's any contact or relationship or whatever, you're going to have to initiate it. Because I'm going to ignore you." That's what I told her. And she said, "Really?" I said, "Yep." And boy, I kept to that. For a month and a half, I would walk down the hall with some guy, and I would see my sophomore, you know, as a senior guy I was working with or discipling, whatever, and walking back after lunch, taking him back to his class, and then I'd go. It was an open campus. And I'd see my daughter, and I'd just stare ahead, walk right by her, never said hi. About a month and a half later, I was sitting on the lawn having lunch with some students, and she came up and sat down. And then just started talking. The next day, she actually joined us again, because I didn't acknowledge her. We entered a conversation. She came and sat down, and she said, "You know, Dad," and one of the kids went, "That's your dad? I thought he was a narc." Seriously, that's what another kid who was a part of that circle of guys that were sitting on the lawn with my friends. Thought I was a narc, but that's how it started. But you have to have a plan, and that's what we're going to talk about for a couple of minutes. Fail to communicate approval and acceptance. Rick Warren did a thing about a month ago, and Rick Warren is Church of Saddleback, tens of thousands, and his sermon I wrote down. He said, what you need to say to your kids. I think it was Father's Day when he preached this sermon. He said, you know what I like about you? And he asked his kids, and his kids would go, he said, my relationship with my kids changed when I said, do you know what I like about you? Absolutely everything. He said, that's God's fatherly love and grace. And if we don't give that to our kids, if we don't see them as perfect, even though they're not, if we just point out their faults, we're in religion, we're in the rules. We need, God's grace says, in fact, this all comes out of Ephesians 5. It says that's how husbands are supposed to love their wives. How does a husband love his wife? The way Christ loved the church. How does Christ love me? He sees me as perfect, not because I am, but because he gives it to me as a, what? A gift. It's by grace that you've been saved, through faith. Not by works, not by performance. It's a gift of God, Ephesians 2, 8, and 9. And every couple I marry, I say, this is what you're saying today. You're saying you're perfect. Not because you are, but because I give you that as my wife. I give you that as a gift, because that's how God loves me. He presents me to himself as holy, perfect, and blameless. And now that I'm old, without stain or wrinkle or blemish, that's what Ephesians 5:20 says, and 21 and 22. He says it's a profound mystery to love somebody that way. It is a profound mystery to love somebody where you say, you're perfect. Not because you are, but I give you that as a gift. I love you that much. And that's why he says to his kids, you know what I love about you? Absolutely everything. Five, fail to communicate approval and accept. Oh, that's what I just read. Fail to keep perspective on what really is important. One of the things that I decided to do early on was to try and say yes. And what I found out, particularly when you're dealing with the government or with people or school, if you ask, is it okay? 80% of the time you'll get a no from any authority figure, anybody. No, we can't do that. 80% no's, and if you're running at 80% no's in your household, it's probably gonna be a discouraged children. Fail to let them develop their own personal identity, try different characteristics or dress or whatever, they try that, and let them, that's part of this progression that you'll see. Fail to give an honest answer to an honest question, and then the last one that ties into yesterday, fail to admit when I'm wrong. And that was one of the lists that my daughter helped me put together when we did the father-daughter retreat. We want to conclude and wrap up today with steps to independence, and I'd like to walk us through that. If you could also help hand these out. This was probably the most fun thing for me, and I told my wife this morning I would give her all the credit, and she said, you don't need to do that. And I said, I always do. And the reason is because it's a progression. If your kids have hope that they will, boy, I didn't stay with this at all. Sorry, but at least you had it in front of you. Most important one. Three promises that I can set your parenting, that can set your parenting compass, and these are the promises that lead into this. I promise to do everything I can to place your hand in the hand of God. And that's probably one of the most important promises you can make your kids, is my goal is not to have your hand in my hand. I'll hold your hand crossing the street, but I want you to make good decisions about when to cross and all that, and that's gonna come real early. When you can cross the street on your own because you know when it's safe. I promise to do everything I can to protect you physically and emotionally. And let me tell you, that was part of the reason for some of my crankiness in Oakland, was that realizing my kids were going to Oakland public schools, and I, in an effort to protect them from what was going on the campus, there were some times that I had to make some tough decisions. And the third one is, I promise to do everything I can to form a loving bond with discipline. Discipline is, interestingly, because discipline defined is to form a loving bond through discipline means to disciple. And that's what I was doing with a lot of other people's kids, being a youth pastor. And I realized that I had to do that with my own. Discipline defined is training that strengthens, that makes them stronger, makes them their character. Correction and control, so order is maintained, meaning so that their life is not chaotic. And a system of rules for conduct, which is how they treat each other and how they treat their friends and how they treat their mom and dad. If your child was in charge of your house for a week, share something you think they would change. And I'm going to skip that, but that might be an interesting question to ask them. What would you change? If you were the authority in this household, what would you change? It'd be interesting just to know what they think. Five traits of a healthy family. And this is a whole amazing book. But strong sense of being committed to each other. When they look for strengths in a healthy family, this is what they found. Strong sense of being committed to each other. Spend time together. Number three was enjoys open, frequent communication. And that's the whole listening thing. Because when the listening stops, communication stops with it. Number two is express affirmation and encouragement often. And that's the whole hug and you know what I like about you, it's everything. And the strong sense of family tradition is, this is what we, oh, sorry. This is, sorry. You ready for it? I had to show this anyway. Because I had this experience. That's how fast it all happens. Trust me, I know. I've had four weddings in my family and was able to perform them all. But boy, the shock from this to who is that guy is a big one. So families that hang together have family traditions and have a plan. And what I'm saying is that one of the things that we did, and again, this could be discouraging, and I hope it's not. You can enter this plan anytime at any place. And the reality is that what we decided that we wanted to do, Ken Poor, who is a major youth leader at Hume Lake, wrote a book, Give Your Kid a Chance. And what he did was he started this thing of boxes, and that's how he describes it. He describes it as a box. And every year they would add new things to the box that the kids got to decide, and it was based on, you know, their how well they did. Is that they took responsibility. With more responsibility that you take and you do it well, the more freedom you get. And that progression gives kids hope. And if they don't have hope, then they just rebel. And so what we did was we did special nights with Dad. And having been the youngest by so many years, we realized when Christy came along, our youngest, she would always have to go to bed earlier than anybody else. So we invented a thing called special nights. And one night a week, each of the kids got to stay up with Mom and Dad later than the other ones. Wasn't that the 14-year-old had to go to sleep, but you got to go to your room, and you can read, you can do your homework, but you got to stay in your room because Christy is only six and she's going to stay out with us and watch something or do something or do some craft or whatever Pam is pretty creative. Special nights with and dates with Dad, and that's when that was my own choice, is when they were potty trained, meaning then they could go with me alone. I didn't want to be going with diapers and poopy and all that stuff, but that was just my own personal thing. But so they all were motivated to get out of diapers and go to the bathroom so they could go on dates like the older sisters did. So anyway, kindergarten was when they started to print their name. And this is, again, you don't have to write these down. Create your own. For us, they were to pick out their clothes. And so they'd pick out clothes to go to church in when they were in kindergarten. And boy, let me tell you, sometimes they would say, that's the pastor's kid? What's he wearing? Or she wearing? Socks, shoes, the way they did their hair, all of that. No makeup, but they could, they did different, they're very creative kids. They were obviously my kids, and they liked to be different. So first grade, we had allowance, and that's when they made their own lunch. So they went to the store with Pam, they bought things for their lunch, and when they, the night before, that was part of the things that they did, they got to make their own lunch, and so they didn't have to eat the sandwiches, and that was nice for Pam, too, because making four lunches was, there was some cross benefit to some of this steps to independence. Second grade was the first slumber party, and home alone for the short times, and all of them knew these were part of the things that if they took responsibility, if they didn't do what the kind of things I did when I was younger, they got more and more freedom. The solo plane ride was the third grade one, and that was one they really looked forward to. Is they got to fly to see Grandma and Grandpa in Southern California from Oakland, and boy, they, as the old one did it, they would all quiz the older one who got to do it, and then, you know, then they would look for their turn, and they made sure we stuck with this plan because it meant they could fly on the plane by themselves. I don't know if that's young for you, but make it fourth grade or whatever. But we just developed this, and this, what we're sharing is not, there's no rules to this. Even be more creative, more fun than we are. But they had this list, and they knew this was coming. That the weekend heart necklace, prep for puberty at 10 years old, they got to pick where they could go. And Wendy, the one that we were, that, you know, was, she's the one who was, I had probably the most difficult with. She picked Dream Inn down here in Santa Cruz, and we were in Oakland. We went down there for the weekend, and we gave her a heart necklace, and we read this, and I read the story. It's a parable, because we talked about puberty and my, you know, how my body changes, and this parable for all the girls was important because it see if you can picture what this parable is about. Three dates, a string of hurried cafeteria lunches, countless rushed snatches of conversation in the halls. Between classes, Matt knew he was in love. That's why he was wandering around downtown for 3 hours. The day before Christmas, he had searched everywhere for a perfect gift, but nothing seemed quite right for Carrie. He finally sauntered into a jewelry store, and after an awkward minutes of looking, he explained to the sales lady he wanted something really nice as a present for his girlfriend. She told him she thought she had just the right thing and led him to a nearby display case. She pulled out a brown velvet box, set it in front of Matt, and waited for his reaction. The moment he opened the box, he saw the gold locket. Matt knew it was perfect. The gold glistened, the light was just like Carrie's eyes. The 14-karat gold chain added a touch of elegance. I've got it almost done. And he knew Carrie couldn't help but love it, so he paid for it, took it home, and very carefully wrapped it. That locket did make a perfect gift, and Carrie thought so too. And Matt knew as long as he lived, he would never forget the night he gave Carrie that gold locket. Winter hadn't reached February before something happened to Matt's love. The warmth seemed to fade. Matt knew Carrie sensed it. He could see the questions in her eyes. Breaking up brought the greatest sense of sadness and loss Matt had ever known. A few months later, Matt met Rita. She was just the opposite, with dark eyes, flashing personality. Love struck again, and Matt decided he wanted to show his love for her with a special gift. And he haunted the stores, trying to decide what to give her. But he always found himself back at that jewelry store for that gold locket. And he racked his brain for other ideas. No other gift seemed as perfect. He ended up giving Rita a locket, and she thought it was beautiful, and Matt was pleased with his selection. Matt and Rita broke up a few months later. After Rita, he dated Barb, and after Barb came Sandy and Arlene and then Nicole, and there was nothing strange about the fact that Matt went from one girlfriend to another, but he really, because he really cared about each one. But it did seem odd that even to Matt, whenever a birthday or some other special occasion called for a special gift, he would return to that familiar jewelry store to buy another gold locket. A couple times he felt a little guilty about not putting more thought or effort into choosing a gift, but even when he tried, he couldn't think of a nicer present than that locket. Finally, Matt met Carol. Right away, there was a different look about him when he was with her, and he knew no one had understood or loved him the way that Carol did, and all this, how his previous loves paled in the light of his love for Carol. No one was surprised when he got married. A few weeks before the wedding, Carol suggested they exchange wedding gifts, and Matt thought that was a great idea, and he wanted this gift to be just as special as the wedding rings they'd picked out, and just as symbolic of his love. He tried to think of something else, but he finally settled on a beautiful gold locket. He went to pick it up at the same jewelry store, and the moment he saw it, he remembered what a perfect gift it was. Nothing seemed to express his love the way the locket did. Their wedding was exciting and beautiful, as was expected. And when the day was over, Matt presented his gift to Carol. She told him that the locket was beautiful and that it was the most wondrous gift she'd ever received. But when Carol put on the locket, Matt couldn't remember all the other gold lockets he'd given. He wondered if Carol knew. He wished he could have given her something unique and special, just for her alone. Always before, that 24-karat gold locket had seemed such a perfect gift. But now, the happiest day of his life, that locket didn't seem so special or beautiful anymore. It didn't even seem as gold as Matt had remembered. And so then we talk. What is that a picture of? And we talk about puberty and change and how your body's going to change and how you're special. And it's about giving yourself away. But we talk about that earlier rather than late. And for some kids these days and age, 10's not even too early. But we read that story and we give them, and then they open a present and it's a gold locket. And they wear it. We came down here to Dream Inn. She picked the location, and each of our daughter, Carrie, picked Tahoe. Another one picked up in Marin, like the wine country. Not because of wine, but she was 10, and we wanted to go up there. And they start babysitting on bank account, then have a teenage plan. For us, pierced ears came later. Family party in the city. This was 13, and this is my last thing I'm going to share just because we've got to quit. But one of the most interesting things that we did with all four girls was we took them into San Francisco to the Pearl Factory. And we said, you're turning 13. It's your 13th birthday. And every one of them we took into there. And then they went to the Pearl Factory where you pull the oysters, the clams out, and they go, aloha, and they crack them open, and you find if there's a pearl or two. We said to the person who was doing that, we said, we want you to tell them the story. And they tell the story. Anybody know what the story is? Anybody know? What do they put in the clam to get a pearl? Grain of sand, right. And why does it create a pearl? Because the shell or the grain of sand that goes into the oyster irritates. And then we look at them and said, you know, honey, these are going to be the years of irritation. These 13, 14, 15 will be the years of irritation. And so we want you to wear this pearl, and every time you look at it, remember, you're going to be irritated with us, we're going to be irritated with you, but if you don't give up, if you hang in there, it's going to create, you're going to be something absolutely precious and priceless and beautiful. But don't give up. And this is the reminder. And one of our, I think it was Carrie, the second one, got two in one oyster, and so she got earrings. She made earrings with it, but other ones did a ring, another one did a necklace. They wanted to be different. So that's kind of what we did, and each one went along and watched it happen until the last one, and Christy she made a necklace and got the little box and put the pearl inside, and it rattled around and stuff. But it was a family tradition, And they recognized that at this point, and that's when they got their phone. And then and eighth grade was the hardest time of the whole growing up period for Pam and I. And so she made, you ever been to a health food store and they have these little like gel capsules you make pills? She did this, and again, I give her credit. She put three, they were like Good and Plenty. They were the purple, they're black paper, white paper, and pink paper. It was like Good and Plenty box. And she put one on pink was a praise and something that we really liked about them. It was something that we saw them do, or we added to this through the year, that eighth grade year. The one was a present, and some of it had to do with a like pedicure. Some of it had to go to the store and buy makeup or whatever. And then there was a verse promise. There are three pills, and every Sunday night we had a ritual. We gathered around before they went to another week of school, opened the big jar, and they got to pick out a black pill, a white pill, and a pink pill, which was a present, a promise, and a praise. And that became a tradition. And they look forward to, and they went, oh, in fact, we would often, it's time to do the pills, and we'd get reminded because you get busy. Then the spiritual confirmation, and at ninth grade on bedtime, at 16th birthday, and this, I said I would, the other one was last, but I really liked driving and wanted them to be, as girls, wanted them to be good drivers, so I told them on their 16th birthday I would take them out of school and take them to DMV and they would get their license. But they had to learn to drive first. And they had to learn to drive from me, and they had to learn to drive a stick. And they went, that's not fair. That's not fair. Everybody else is taking driver's ed with the automatics. I'm going, you're going to learn to drive a stick because I don't want you ever stuck dependent on some guy and can't drive because it's a stick and you don't know how to, I want you, just like a guy, to be able to drive. At that time, some guys couldn't even drive a stick then either. So I taught them to drive on a VW Bug. And when it came down to do the driver's test, I made them go to the DMV in Oakland in a stick, in a 71 powder blue VW Bug. In fact, I still have one of the bugs that I had. And they learned to drive, but they were mad until Robin, the oldest, went for a driver's test on her birthday. And they all quizzed her when she got home, the younger ones. What was it like? I know you're mad at Dad because he made you go to driver's test. She goes, it went okay. And I said, well, tell him what happened. Because I went with her and was waiting around the corner. Well, actually, one of the things we did was we would take the bug down and we'd sit outside the DMV and we'd follow the test, and we found out that there's about three different routes they usually take. And so I wanted to help my kids be confident, and you're driving a stick, and there's things that I'll do for you if we work together on this. She said, you won't believe it, actually. She kind of laughed. She says, the guy got in the car and looked over, and I'm 16, and I'm driving, and he goes, okay, pull out. And I put it in first, and pull out, and he goes, turn right. She said, about a block and a half later, he threw the clipboard on the floor and said, just go up here, turn around, and we'll go back. And they went, no way. She said, he figured if I was confident enough to show up on a stick to pass my test, he didn't. And so all four of them passed their driver's test in a little bug stick, and they are proud of it. So here's my daughter's almost 17, and she has a boyfriend in Walnut Creek. They go out one day. One day she comes back, and she said, Dad, I love you. I said, yeah, what brought that on? She said, I'm out at, she talked about her current boyfriend at the time. And she said, the parents got stranded and they called home and said, can you come and pick us up? And the only car there was a stick, and my 18-year-old boyfriend didn't know how to drive a stick. So I drove the parents' car to go pick them up. She went, yes! So sometimes you come out a hero even when you don't plan to, so. 11th, visit college campuses, and 12th, they're on their own, adult curfew. At 11th grade, they got to visit Seattle Pacific, West, whatever, they got to pick a couple places. Let's pray and conclude. College is not the end, but it's the beginning. And And that's something we had kind of special for our kids, that they had that hope that they would go. God, thank you for this chance to just meet together to talk about family. It's your design, your plan. And God, I just pray that we, as a part of your family, would model our family after yours. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.